Stockholm, which is a paper we, I mean, about some paper we did with my student Laura Bernard, postdoc Michael von Strauss, and next one with Agnieszka Schmidt-May about considering or building or writing a consistent massive graviton theory on arbitrary background. So here is a plan of my talk, and because some big sister is watching, I should say my maybe European big sister, I should say that my work is financed by this grant because these guys are quite picky about that. So anyway, so okay, so here is the plan of my talk. So I will first remind some very, very basic stuff about Fierce-Pauli theory, then discuss how to extract a massive graviton out of DRGT theory, and then count degrees of freedom there. So there are two, so this is the magic of this talk. There is two papers I would like to mention before going on. One with Garato and Dürer, who did the same type of extraction, but in a non-covariant way out of the DRGT theory, and then apply it to Friedmann, Lemaître, Robertson-Walker space-time, which this first part I think is correct, the second part is not, I think. And then there is a second paper, which I discovered only recently by these guys, so some years ago. And what these guys did is that they tried to build a consistent theory for a massive graviton on some arbitrary background. So basically, the idea is that you take some graviton H mu, and then you say you add every possible term which are quadratic into this graviton. So you contract with some tensor. The first bit would be just of course metric dependent term, right? Like say G mu nu, etc. And then you can go further and ask what is the next non-trivial correction depending on the curvature linearly. So you can build some linear in curvature piece. And so what they did is that they wrote all possible terms which are linear in curvature and try to get a consistent theory, meaning here a theory with a correct number of degrees of freedom on such arbitrary curve background. And so they claimed to have obtained this result at linear order in the curvature. And what is also relevant for this particular meeting is that they argued that the obtained theory is causal in the sense that it does not have superluminal propagation mode after you take into account constraints. So I will comment on what the relation to this work with of the of to our work of this work. Okay, so let me first discuss a bit of Fierce-Pauli theory. So this is a some kind of reason, also a way for me to introduce some notations. I think everybody knows Fierce-Pauli theory. Well, which we can define just starting from Einstein inverse action, and then say expanding it on around some background, which to begin with will be taken to be flat, right? So we start with a kinetic term, so will be a bunch of kinetic term. I don't need to write them explicitly. Like dH square. And then you add some mass term on flat space, right, which has to be of this particular form, as we know, in order to avoid ghost and tachyon and propagate the right number of degrees of freedom. So if you now write the equation of motion of this theory schematically, they read as follows. So you have a kinetic term. Coming from the kinetic piece of the action, plus a mass term, which has to be of this form, which is of this form, where eta is a flat metric, and so in vacuum this is just now zero. And so I will need this equation later, so I cheated a bit since I'm using a blackboard, so it's upstairs. Right. Okay. So then one can easily count degrees of freedom starting from this equation, noticing first that if one takes the partial derivative of the kinetic operator, it is zero by virtue of the Bianchi identity. And hence, on shell, it leads to these four equations, which are just four vector constraints. So this vector constraint will stay in this way. I mean, we will be obtained in a similar way on curve space-time. Unlike the next step, which is to obtain an extra constraint, a scalar constraint, because this vector constraint allows you a priori to go from you know, 10 degrees of freedom minus 4, which is 6. Since you have 4 vector constraints, you have 10 to begin with in H mu nu, so it goes to 6 degrees of freedom. So I'm discussing everything here in the Lagrangian language, not in the Hamiltonian language. So you have these 4 vector constraints, and so you need an extra one to get to this famous 5, right? Okay, so how to get the extra one it can be done in the following way. You first can notice that you have this identity, which is off shell. So it allows me to introduce this notation. This sim symbol means that two things are equal off shell up to undifferentiated or once differentiated H mu nu. So it will have the same meaning in the rest of the talk. So I have this identity, and now the interesting thing is that this piece is also as the same form as the derivative of the vector constraint here, right? So and this is peculiar to Fierce-Pauli. So we have, in other words, we have this identity which is valid off-shell, that if you take twice the derivative of the field equation plus the trace with correct coefficient, you get that it vanishes weakly in this sense off-shell. So this is peculiar to Fierce-Pauli, and if you take any other mass term than Fierce-Pauli, you don't get this identity, because any other mass term would result in a coefficient here different from 1, and hence, if you add those two guys, you would get second derivative, right? And so because you have this identity in Fierce-Pauli, now if you go on shell and you compute what is the value of this guy, you find this is just a trace multiplied by some number. So it gives that the trace is just 0 on shell, which gives one scalar constraint. So this is a quick way to count degrees of freedom in Fierce-Pauli. And in fact, one can ask whether one can sort, first of all, write you know, a similar theory as Fierce-Pauli, but on arbitrary background. So this is also the question asked by this Burbinder et al. Paper, and then also count degrees of freedom there, so which is the purpose of the second part of my talk. So it is known for a long time how to do it on a, not on arbitrary curve background, but on Einstein space. And in fact, you can do exactly the same reasoning as nicely explained in particular in the paper of Massimo dating back a few years ago on Einstein space. But so far, I don't think it was known how to do it on arbitrary space-time. So that's what I'm going to do now. So let me keep this up for future reference. And so the starting point here is just the DRGT theory that is now well known, that I'm going to redefine. So I consider some Einstein-Hilbert action again. Plus some interaction term with the dynamical metric G and some extra metric F. So if you want this, because I will not specify the form of the metric F, and in fact I will allow F to be arbitrary, this is an extension of DRGT that was discussed probably for the first time by Rachel and Fawad. And then I can couple this metric to matter, right, in the standard way, say, but I will forget about this part in my talk. And so this interaction term is just written in the usual way, where I'm using now this also parametrization due, I believe, to Fawad and collaborator, and Rachel, probably, where I'm using this beta parameter. So I have four non-trivial terms, where this so this beta are just real number, and this ek are just the usual symmetric function of the tensor S. So the first one is just identities, and you have the trace, and then you have other one. I mean, e2 is just 1/2 of trace of S square minus trace of S square, and e3 is cubic. So where S is just the famous square root, right? So S is defined just as being obeying this equation, that S mu nu, S nu rho is F mu u g, no, sorry, this is the other one, yeah, with g nu rho, okay. F nu. Okay, so this is square root of g minus 1 f. Okay. So now it's easy to, of course, to get the field equations from this action. And the field equation are written here. So you have a bit which is just the Einstein tensor, and then this is what comes from the potential. And so here I consider the simplified case where beta 3 and beta 2 are just vanishing. So I just write the field equation in the simplest case where only beta naught and beta 1 are non-vanishing. So the field equation takes this form here, where I also define this v mu nu tensor, which is this guy. So in fact, the nice aspect of this case is that, as you see here, the field equation are just linear into S tensor. So which means you can solve for S in terms of the metric in a unique way, because you can invert by this equation easily. And you can solve for S in terms of the curvature of the metric G and the metric itself, which is the delta here. So that will play a role in the following, because it means that since we are going to expand now this theory around some background, this background will depend on some value of S. So it means in this field equation, in this linearized field equation, we can replace everywhere S by a function of the curvature, and we can completely get rid of the second metric, at least at perturbative level. So we can obtain a theory for a single graviton moving in a single metric, and where there is no trace of F metric anymore, and which we cannot do explicitly in the other cases. Because in the other cases, you would have to solve some at least quadratic or cubic equation for S, and you cannot get such a simple theory. Okay, so then the next step is to linearize this field equation, which is in principle straightforward. So you just want to compute delta mu nu. So you have a piece which is easy to get, which is the linearization of the Einstein tensor, and a piece which is not easy to get, which is the linearization of V, delta V mu nu. So you expand the metric G in around some arbitrary background, and you linearize. And so to get this delta V mu nu, you need to get delta S mu nu, so the linearization of the square root. And to do that, you can just start from the definition of the square root, and linearize this. So this is S square, right? And if you linearize this, you get an equation which is a matrix equation of this form. So you have delta S times S plus S delta S is equal to delta S square, obviously. And delta S square is easy to get in terms of the perturbation H, right? Because it's just depending on the inverse of the metric. But now you want to get delta S really to compute the linearization of V. And this a priori is not very easy, in fact. And you can show nonetheless that it's possible, because this equation is analogous to an equation which is called the Sylvester equation in the literature. So it's again the same Sylvester as Massimo. So this is this equation for a matrix. So you have the three known matrices A, B, C, and an unknown X, and you want to compute X as a function of A, B, and C. So this is a Sylvester matrix equation. So in fact, Sylvester is also the guy, I believe, who invented the term matrix. So it's a bit redundant maybe to call it Sylvester matrix equation, but anyway. Okay, so the point is that this equation can be solved in a unique way. So it has this equation as a unique solution X if and only if the spectrum of A and the spectrum of minus B do not intersect. So it's a theorem. And so for us, A is replaced by S, and B is replaced also by S. So we will have a unique solution to this equation if spectrum of S and spectrum of minus S do not intersect. So if they do intersect, which can happen, then I think we cannot linearize the DRGT theory. So I have no idea if it has any interesting physical meaning, but this is seems to be the case. Okay, so now one can use this Sylvester equation, and in fact, in the mathematical literature, there are people who are giving you the expression of x as a function of c, which is then linear in c, and also it's a polynomial expression of a and b. Even though we didn't know that before, in fact, we computed this solution ourselves, and then we checked that it agrees with this solution known in the literature. And then you can compute delta s as a function of h, and plug it into this equation here. And formally, you get something which looks like that, right? So let me put this a little bit up. Okay. So we can compute explicitly the form of this mass term. So this mass term will now depend on the curvature via the expression of S. So this equation of motion can be solely expressed now in terms of one metric and its curvature tensor, and there is no need to use anymore this extra F metric. Okay, so this is a starting point. So in principle, this gives, you know, consistent, in the sense of the title of my talk, a theory for a massive graviton on completely arbitrary background. So the expression of the tensor which appear in this equation are a bit complicated. So I will not write their expression explicitly, but just give their general form somehow. So you see it makes use of this big tensor F mu nu rho sigma contracted with H. And so there is a first simple term such as this one, where E1 is just the E1 which appear here. And then you have more complicated term, like you have a contraction of H with S of this type, for example. And then so you have even more complicated one, right? This one is pretty simple. So these are coefficients which are scalar coefficients which depend solely on S. And then you have this is contracted with you know, with some tensor, whatever. This is contracted then with H. And it goes on until the last term, which this term can potentially contain not only, you know, the metric but also S. And so the last non-trivial term is the one which contains power 3 of the curvature or S tensor rather of this type. And here I didn't write about 10 complicated terms. And so it stops at cubic in curvature or cubic in S. So the reason why it stops there, well, you can see it using this Sylvester theorem or whatever, but you can understand why, because in fact the trick is when you compute this naively, you don't see that it stops at cubic order. The trick is to use a last theorem, the Kelly-Hamilton famous theorem, which tells you that you know, if you take an arbitrary matrix, this characteristic polynomial vanishes, and so it means that you can extract all the higher power of S higher than 4 in terms of linear combination of lower power. This you can inject back into the equation of motion or action and express everything in terms of S power up to power 3. So you have a complicated equation, but everything is finite. So it's not an infinite series in the curvature, and it stops at S to the power 3. Okay. And we will use this theorem also later. Okay, so the next step is last of my talk is to count degrees of freedom in this theory here. Yes. Sorry. So the Russian paper stopped at order 1 in curvature.
So done.
Yeah, but in fact, no. First of all, they argued that you cannot stop at finite order. They argued that there is an infinite series of terms necessary, and in fact, I wanted to say that at the end of my talk. But what is very strange, which I don't understand, in fact, so far. However, we didn't. I discovered this paper quite recently, so it might might have something I didn't completely understand. Or is that if we expand this equation of motion or action at a linear order in the curvature, we don't get back the result. So there seems to be, however, their result should be compatible with this because it's only based on, you know, having the right number of degrees of freedom, even though they insist the theory should be causal also. But the causality in their case comes for free because it's not fixing any of the parameter of their theory. Sorry? Right, but as I said, the causality argument should not interfere here because the causality argument, they say the theory is causal by construction, and what matters is really the number of degrees of freedom if you truncate the theory at you know, linear level. And this does not match with the expansion of this theory at linear level, which I, what? No, I didn't so far, but yeah.
So if you look at the beta 1 model,
right?
If you look at a more general case,
yes,
then would it include that theory?
We are doing that now. So it seems I'm not sure what is the result, but we did that as well for the beta 2 and for the beta 3 case. And in fact, these cases are quite different. So I will say a bit more at the end. But so I have no idea what we find is different from what they found. But okay, so now the last question is to count degrees of freedom here, right? And so the first step, so one has to follow this type of reasoning extended to curved space-time. So the first step is to use again a Bianchi identity, right? To notice that because this is a weakly zero, by virtue of the Bianchi identity, you can easily get four vector constraints as on a flat space by just taking a covariant derivative of the equation of motion. So if you do that, right, you have that this is now equal to m squared d mu of m mu nu, this small m, which contains now everything. And so this is zero weakly, and so on shell, because this is zero on shell. So this gives four vector constraints, right? So this is easy. And it's known, of course, that it does work. And so it goes from 10 to 6. OK, so the last step, which is not easy, is a scalar constraint. So of course, one knows that it does work because of one knows that DRGT propagate the right number of degrees of freedom. But one should be able to show it in this way as well. So here we want to follow the same track as the Pierce-Pauli. So we want to take second derivative of the field equation, a priori, right? Which is also what can be done for Einstein spacetime. So we want to take some second derivative of the field equation, say. What we really want to know, what we really want to do, sorry, is to take this derivative here with just one index contracted, and then trace this with something. So we can trace it with a metric. But here, let me put in the indices this way. Here, the point is that we can trace it not only with a metric, but we can trace it with curvature also, right? So we can trace it with curvature, or we can trace it also with curvature square, etc., right? So we have, a priori, an infinite way to trace this equation. And similarly, if we take the real trace of the equation, we can trace it with a metric, but also with curvature, curvature square, etc. So what one really wants to do is to consider, in fact, all these possible ways to trace. So we define this psi I scalar as just the trace of the second derivative of the field equation traced with the curvature to the power I. And then we similarly, we take this trace of the field equation with a curvature to the power I as well. So this phi. And in fact, thanks to the Cayley-Hamilton theorem, we can stop here to only I lower than or equal to 3. Because all the other term will be a linear combination of these, right? So so it means one has to consider 8 possible terms, and one wants to find a linear combination of these terms. Which weakly vanishes. So we want to find some u and v such that ui psi I plus vi phi I just vanishes weakly, where u and v are just, you know, scalar. So is it possible? So the first one can first notice that if you take such a linear combination, this is a linear combination itself of 26 different scalar. So notice that string theory is popping out here. Yes. Well, because I want to do it in a Lagrangian you know, sense.
You get the same thing.
I didn't check, in fact, but probably yeah. Right, but it's again it's written in a complicated Hamiltonian form, and also
double the first order.
No, yeah, you worked it in a field-bound formalism,
yeah,
which is
well,
it's not so clear because you know the field-bound and the metric formalization. Yeah, maybe. Yeah, that's not what we did, but that's possible. A possibility to go. okay, so you get 26 scalar, right? This we call this scalar some Aleph scalar. And these scalar are made out of a contraction of H, of derivative of H, sorry, because what we're really interested in is into the second derivative of H appearing here, and we want to get rid of all these second derivative. So these scalars, they are made of contraction of H with S. So one of them is, simple ones which do not contain any S. So we call this J. So J1 and J2 are inside this Aleph set. And then there is the one which contains first power of S, whereby, you know, every time I write S, I mean, in fact, S replaced by curvature and the metric, because I want to write everything in terms of just one metric and its curvature. So I have a bunch of these which are linear in S. And the last one are containing, again, cubic power of S. So one of them is this one. Etc. So it stopped at 20, there's 26 of them. And so a priori, each of these 26 scalar gives one equation which you should solve for u and v. So you see you have 8 unknowns and 26 equations, which a priori is not working, right? But the point is that, in fact, these scalar are not independent from each other. And that you don't see at first. So to see that, you can use, again, some version of the Cayley-Hamilton theorem to find a relation between invariants, which are scalar in this case. So one way to go is to consider this Cayley-Hamilton theorem for a matrix M, which you take as a linear combination of four matrices, four arbitrary matrices. So A, B, C, D, big A, big B, big C, big D are just arbitrary matrices, and small a, etc., are real number. So, and you have the property that Cayley-Hamilton of M is just zero, right, by construction. And this, in fact, gives a non-trivial identity between these matrices if you extract the term which have the same homogeneity in A, B, C, D. So this is called sometimes, apparently, the second fundamental theorem of invariant theory by clever people, so that you can get some invariant some non-trivial relation between matrices using this type of argument. So you extract, you know, a given all the terms which have the same homogeneity in ABCD separately, and you get some invariants. And then you take this invariant. So this invariant, they are you know, some matricial equation of the type let's call it curly M. Is some you know, linear combination of A, B, C, D to some power, etc. And so you stick into this equation, you stick that A is equal to H, B is equal to S, C is equal to S squared, D is equal to S cubed. And then you get some non-trivial equation on H, S, S squared, S cubed. You take second derivative of this equation, and you act with all the derivative on H. And you should select also, because you're interested in something which is linear in small h, you should select all the terms which are linear in A. And so you get some non-trivial equations, which are also called sometimes CZG in this context, between the invariants which are made out of these alephs. And in fact, there are four non-trivial CZGs for us, which mattered, which tells you that this aleph coefficient, this aleph scalar, sorry, are not all independent. So, for example, one of these CZG is telling you that you have A1 minus A2, etc., where there's a bunch of terms. The last term is E3 squared G1 minus G2, and this is weakly zero. Then you stick this into your 26 equation. And at the end of the day, you get seven equations, seven independent equations, which is exactly what you want, because you have, in fact, seven unknown, because you can always set one of the unknown to one. So at the end of the day, you find the constraint you look for. And it's quite simple, in fact, once you have found it. So it has the following form. So you have a minus m squared, beta 1, E4 over 2 phi naught plus minus E3 psi naught plus E2 psi 1 minus E1 psi 2 plus psi 3 is 0. And so this is a scalar constraint. It's in fact weakly 0. And on shell, it is giving a scalar constraint. So one can check also that this guy. So this is the fifth constraint, which eliminates this extra degree of freedom. And so one can show that this guy goes to H simply on curve spacetime, which are Einstein spacetime. So on flat spacetime and Einstein spacetime, one recovers the H equals zero constraint that is known for a long time. So this is how, in fact, one can. One can get this extra constraint in this language. And so I think I'm done here. So thank you for your attention.
Just by going away from Einstein background, your equation, the analog of the first Pauli equation became very complicated.
Right.
So, can one take from here the lesson that if you want to construct a partially maskless theory, which is valid away from PM, away from residual backgrounds, then you cannot start from Pierre Pauli equation?
There are several outcomes of that. And in fact, one good question, which was also raised by Kurt in Stockholm, was whether one can use that to see if there is a partially massless theory away from Einstein background, because there is obstruction theorems in principle. So the starting point is just to take this constraint and see if it has solution, non-trivial solution once you impose some condition on the background. But we have not done that yet, but this is an interesting question.
Can you talk about counting the number of these relations?
Yeah, in fact, that's a very good question, because maybe Massimo knows, but I looked in the literature and I don't know if it's known. So it seems it's not known how to count the number of these invariants. So for us, we just blindly computed all of them. I mean, the one we didn't need, and we checked.
Do you have a theorem that counts them because you don't, the RGT should work in any
Maybe. That's a good point, yeah. So, yes.
There are no other questions?
Well, actually, one question about the analysis of characteristics.
Right.
Yeah, you, what can we say?
So you can do the analysis of characteristics, but we have not done it. And that's a very good question. I mean, other people did it in some other way, but that's, of course, a very good question. What I'm puzzled with is this paper, is the relation, I should say one thing in relation to these two papers I mentioned at the beginning. First of all, this paper of Garato and Durer, so they did the same expansion on, you know, not in a covariant way first, so we did it in covariant way, and we checked that this first part of the calculation agreed with them, so in other words, our linearized equation agreed with them, their equation, which are written in a non-covariant way. Then they specialized to Friedman, Lemaître, Bassan, Walker spacetime, and the background they are taking is not correct. So we think that we have the correct equation. If you want to write a massive graviton on an arbitrary FRW spacetime, you should use our equation, not their equation, because their equation is not. You will not get this constraint. Basically, so you will not get the set number of degrees of freedom. And then the relation to the first paper of Gitman and company, or Bourbinder, is that again we don't find this. We seem similarly don't find the same equation as there, but their view that their, you know, their theory is causal, you know, it doesn't have superliminal propagation, and they look at characteristics using their equation. So I don't know so what's going on here. So right.
Are there any further questions? Okay.